The lower court, in its February 22nd, 08 order, engaged in an inherent false syllogism, which is, I think, the best way to put it. Because in that particular opinion, the court held that there was no duty to defend, but yet at the same time held that the duty to indemnify was not yet ripe for adjudication or decision by the court. And therefore, on the motions for summary judgment, granted them in part on the duty to defend and denied them on the duty to indemnify. This is a syllogistically, if there is such a word, impossibility for the following reason. If indemnification, as the court held, was not ripe, then it follows, as day follows night, that there is the potential for coverage. And under Illinois law, if there is even a potential for coverage, then the duty to defend is absolute.
Could indemnification come for a different reason?
Could the court perhaps speak a tad louder? I'm sorry.
The indemnification, couldn't it come from a different reason, a violation of the law, for example?
Well, then there would still be a duty to indemnify, because in fact, what the court did, if I understand the court's question correctly, and one of the flaws in the decision of the court below, was that it adopted an incorrect standard. It used the headings, didn't analyze the factual allegations in the underlying complaint, because indeed those factual allegations could have led to any number of covered causes of action, whether they were addressed or stated or not. I believe that is what the court wanted to know. The answer is yes, and it is for that very reason that Moments Meadows, my client, was entitled to...
What case law supports your argument that we should take the facts alleged on the underlying complaint, hypothesize all causes of action that can be alleged from those facts, and then decide whether the duty to defend is triggered? Because reading through the cases, they seemed to support limiting review to the legal claims that were actually alleged instead of some hypothetical legal claims. And, you know, I mean, is there a best case for you on this point?
It is HFP is one case, and Wilkins is the other case, and these are Illinois cases that stand for the proposition that the problem is there have been so many cases cited, like 50 or so, between the briefs, it's sometimes difficult calling up the precise one, but I'm pretty sure in this case it's the HFP and the Wilkins case. Illinois cases, I believe one or both out of the Illinois Supreme Court, that stand for that very proposition, that you look to the allegations, the factual allegations, never mind the headings. And if you take a look at the headings, indeed it is qui tam, that is alleged, but it is qui tam that the court below held is not a covered cause of action, and I don't think we can disagree with that, nor do we disagree with that. But the fact remains is, as the court will see in a moment, or hear from me in a moment, the way the policy is written, given the factual allegations that are alleged, there are multiple opportunities for coverage. You don't look at the headings, you look at the factual allegations. So therefore, conversely, if there is or might be coverage based upon the factual allegations, then there is, as a matter of law, under HPF and Wilkins, an absolute duty to defend. Conversely, or putting it the other way, if there is no coverage, then there can never be the duty to indemnify to ripen at a future date. The court could have, and the court did not, say that here and now there is no coverage. And if there is no coverage, then there is, of course, not a duty to defend. I lose. And there can't ever become a duty to indemnify, in which case the case would be over, but the court didn't do that.
Well, that doesn't matter. We can say that now. And we ought to under our case law, the case law that you just alluded to.
I would like to impress upon the court why there are other reasons that the court, if so inclined, or should become so inclined to do so, perhaps ought not to do so. And let me then address the second point. And that is at A-124 is the resignation letter of one of the relators in the underlying complaint, a lady by the name of Apsher, a former Moments Meadows nurse. Under the policy, under this policy, and the underlying complaint, which is, I think, the point the court was trying to make, coverage isn't really theoretical. You're saying, well, it's merely theoretical. Your Honor said that it was merely theoretical. And don't we have to look at something more than mere theory? I'm going to about give the court something that is far more than mere theory. The policy expressly covers invasion of privacy at A53. And the policy says, oral or written publication of material that violates a person's right of privacy is a covered risk. In this particular case, at A124, one of the plaintiffs alleges, that's Apsher, that her resignation letter was faxed by Moments Meadows to prospective employees. What's really important about that is the content of her letter, her resignation letter, because in her resignation letter, she discusses that she is resigning, taking a leave of absence. I'm not sure it's entirely clear that she is taking this termination or leave of absence because of an emergency mental health issue with her. Now, if indeed, as alleged in the underlying complaint, factually that is what happened, then that would be a publication of something that is an inherently private matter and ought not to have been sent elsewhere. And mental distress, which is what she claims she suffered on account of that, and she alleges that, and that's actually the gravamen of counts 3 and 4, is that mental distress is covered. Counts 3 and 4 claim bodily injury to herself by reason of mental distress. In the underlying policy, the only mental distress which is excluded from coverage is that by reason of sexual misconduct. There's no allegation here whatsoever, unlike perhaps the case preceding mine, that there was any sexual misconduct. So we don't have that in this case. Therefore, under the policy, whatever mental distress there was, which she says there was, whether there was or was not, did not arise out of sexual misconduct, and therefore, because it is not within the exclusion, it is a covered bodily injury. If you have one basis upon which to defend, then the insurance company owes the insured an absolute complete duty to defend on all counts. In this case, that's even easier, because in her A-124 resignation letter, she gives as her basis the ongoing alleged bodily injuries, violations that Moments Meadows had committed. So really they are and become merged as one of the same factual bases. So,
and yet, of course, this is not a malpractice case.
It is not. Could it become so? Possibly, yes. We believe the court's fundamental core basic error was to misapply the standard being don't look at the headings, look at the factual allegations.
Could you repeat that? My ears are not that great.
Of course, I'm sorry. As I indicated a moment ago, because I had said this earlier, the fundamental flaw in the court below's reasoning was adopting, which is easier to do, the headings as opposed to analyzing actual factual allegations required under Illinois law. I now get to, I think, the final point, and that is the because of language in the policy. The policy uses repeatedly and only the phrase, meaning covered risks, because of bodily injury. The appellee, in all of their filings below and in their response brief before this court, keep trying to substitute the policy language because of, with the more restrictive for bodily injury, even though the word for bodily injury never appears in any of the policies. And that is because of the phrase because of, quote, subsumes and covers direct and indirect causations, where by comparison the phrase for would be more restrictive, only covering direct causation, as for example in a malpractice claim.
But the nurses aren't making any claims for their own bodily injury.
Well, actually, Absher is in counts 3 and 4, Your Honor.
Well, those are emotional distress claims, and the case law excludes those from the definition of bodily injury under CGL policies.
In the policy, I believe at A53, if memory serves, there is in fact a reference to bodily injury and disease, and disease would include under this coverage because of the excluding mental distress on account of sexual misconduct, meaning perforce. If it isn't within the exclusion, it is covered, and since the only excluded mental distress is on account of sexual misconduct, reasoning the other way, everything else is a covered risk.
But bodily injury, as used in insurance policies, has been construed to refer to physical injury, an emotional distress claim only. Physical injury and then, you know, any pain and suffering associated with a physical injury, which is includes a mental component as well as a physical component, but not a freestanding claim for emotional injury unaccompanied by any physical injury.
Well, actually, in counts 3 and 4, they do make the claim for mental distress.
That's my point, is that that's not covered under a bodily injury clause in insurance policy, or at least that's what the Illinois case law holds, and that's the general rule.
But it does
in
this policy. But it does in this policy at 853. So Illinois case law would only apply if the contract of insurance didn't provide otherwise.
A53, it sounds like from your argument, is an exclusion.
It is an exclusion, and the exclusion.
And exclusions don't create coverage. You cannot argue by negative inference from an exclusion
that creates
coverage.
But they help define an ambiguous term, as for example bodily injury, under the risk what is covered section, and when it says that the mental distress that is not covered is that by reason of sexual misconduct, you have to interpret that, as I see it, as every other type of mental distress in fact being covered. I mean, that is the way the policy is written. I do want to save some time for rebuttal, if I may. Thank you, Your Honor.
Morning, Ms. Wetherill.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Jill Wetherill. May it please the court, counsel. I'd like to begin by first addressing one of the points made by Mr. Hoffman in his argument before this court. One of the first things the court asked him was what case law supported his position that the court is to consider something other than the actual allegations in the underlying complaint and not some hypothetical complaint. And he said his best cases were Wilkins and HPF. In reviewing the cases in preparation for today, I do not see any Wilkins case that's been cited to the court, and I believe the case he was referring to was the Watts case. Under the Watts case, the court at the district court level, as well as in our briefs, we have distinguished that case with a clear understanding that in Watts, what the court was considering was a water damage claim, and the interveners came in, the municipalities, and said, we have actual property damage. And they made allegations of property damage in conjunction with the quitom action, which was seeking recovery by a private entity on behalf of the public one. That's a completely different set of facts than we have in this case.
The real question here seems to be whether we should look at the factual allegations or the legal allegations when we are deciding whether the duty to defend is triggered. If we look at the factual allegations, there are certainly losses and damages because of bodily injury. Why isn't that enough? These aren't hypothetical factual allegations. their actual allegations, albeit pled to support a different legal theory.
Your Honor, you actually do consider the factual allegations of the underlying complaint, HealthCap is not denying that that is the case. The court is to compare the factual allegations in the underlying complaint to the policy coverage. However, the courts have also decided in the HPF case, which was one of the cases that Mr. Hoffman said was in their favor, the court said you look at the factual allegations, but the factual allegations that underlie a statutory cause of action in a quitam situation are not the actual facts that support their claim. The facts that support the claim in this case are facts that are going to support the False Claims Act claims and the Illinois Whistleblower Act claims. And what they are purporting to put forth in their complaints in count 1 and 2 are claims that there was fraudulent billing to the United States and State of Illinois healthcare, Medicaid, and Medicare systems. They are not making bodily injury claims on behalf of the residents and, in fact, could not be making them. The plaintiffs in the underlying case would not have standing to make such a claim of bodily injury on behalf of the residents, and they haven't put those types of claims forward. The types of claims they are making are claims for fraudulent billing services, which under HPF and cases that have subsequently cited that have found are not a sufficient bodily injury claim to trigger coverage under a general liability policy.
If Absher subsequently brought a malpractice claim against Moments, would the fact findings from this quitam action about injuries suffered by the residents be raised judicata in a subsequent malpractice case?
They would not. A malpractice action brought by Absher, which is barred by the statute of limitations and is a red herring argument that's been raised periodically throughout the briefs, as she died in 2002 and it's now 2009, no claim like that has been brought and could not at this point. But if she did, it would be a separate cause of action. And to make their claim in this case, in the underlying case, the relators only have to prove that there was a false billing, that it was presented to the United States government or the State of Illinois government, and that it was presented when they knew it was false. They don't have to prove that there was any actual bodily injury in their underlying action. It's not an element of their claim. So since that's not an element of their claim, and all they have to prove is the false billing, there would be no res judicata issue. Now, with regard to another point raised by Mr. Hoffman, he wanted to focus the court's attention on the fact that the lower court found that there was no duty to defend but would not decide the duty to indemnify. While I agree that the duty to defend encompasses the duty to indemnify, the fact that the lower court did that I do not think requires this court to reverse them on the duty to defend issue.
But it does require a declaration that there is no duty to indemnify.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. I would say that a duty to indemnify is a subcategory of the duty to defend, and that the duty to indemnify was right for ruling by the lower court. The lower court felt, based on the case law, that it was not a right issue at that time. But it was.
What else would need to happen to ripen the issue of duty to indemnify?
I can't think of anything that would be needed to ripen that issue. I do understand the lower court relied on case law that was presented by the defendants and the appellants in this matter, indicating that the duty to indemnify is not ripe until the underlying action is resolved. And I think the lower court got a little bit hung up on that because the underlying action is not resolved. But I think they erred in not seeing that the duty to indemnify is a subcategory of the duty to defend.
There might be a ripeness issue if the duty to indemnify was freestanding and not coupled in the same policy with a duty to defend in the case of a third-party policy as opposed to a first-party policy. But we've got a first-party policy here.
That's correct. Okay. That's correct. Now, the appellant also raises issues with regard to the emotional distress claims that are alleged in the underlying complaint by Absher. Those emotional distress claims do not state a claim for bodily injury. As has been indicated by this court, general liability policies, bodily injury definitions have been found to not include an emotional distress claim. In addition to that, any emotional distress claim that she has raised arises out of her employment with Moments Nursing Center, and the employment-related exclusion clearly excludes those. So the language of the employment-related exclusion is clear and unambiguous, and it excludes all claims that arise out of your employment or termination or the employment-related practices of the nursing home in this matter. So any claims that she might make in her counts 3 and 4 with regard to the retaliatory discharge, including claims of emotional distress fall squarely within that exclusion. The last portion of the policy that they asked this court under which to find coverage is the professional liability policy. As you look at the professional liability policy, clearly this is not a malpractice claim. And the professional liability policy requires that there be a medical incident arising out of the providing or withholding of professional services. That's clearly not the case in any of the four counts raised in the underlying complaint. Your Honors, boiled down, this is simply two claims for fraud and two claims for retaliatory discharge. We have a general liability policy that doesn't cover fraud and an employment-related exclusion that excludes retaliatory discharge claims. It's not a complicated issue. It does not require a large and extensive evaluation of anything other than just looking basically at what does a general liability policy cover and what does an employment-related exclusion that's clearly worded exclude. And in this case, the underlying complaint is two counts of fraud, one against the Federal Claims Act and one under the Illinois Whistleblower Act, and two claims for retaliatory discharge. And I'd ask the court affirm the lower court's finding that there is no duty to defend in this matter and make a declaration that there's also no duty to indemnify. And unless there's any other questions, I'm concluded. Thank you.
I begin my rebuttal by perhaps by apologizing because I think I set the court off in a wrong. Unfortunately, I didn't come here alone this morning. My colleagues set me correct on which of the cases it is that holds. What it is the court was asking me earlier, before specifically Judge Mannion. It is Illinois Amasco Insurance Company versus Northwestern National Casualty Company, which says that the Illinois court found a duty to defend where any theory of liability, pleaded or not pleaded, could give rise to coverage. The court in Amasco said the duty to defend does not require that the complaint, what we've been calling the underlying complaint, allege or use language affirmatively bringing the claims within the scope of the policy. The question of coverage should not hinge on the draftsmanship skills or whims of the plaintiff in the underlying case. So I do apologize, but that case law is there, and it is the it is an Illinois appellate court decision. Then I would do want to cover back again the question of the because of language. The policy repeatedly says because of. I do see that my time is up. I think I can conclude this.
You've got time.
Okay. It's the red. I'm sorry, of course. And the because of language being far more inclusive than what they keep trying to thrust upon the court as the which is as the non-existent for bodily injury language really redounds down to the following. Let's assume the qui tam claim is the issue of whether or not it falls within the risk of coverage under this particular policy, quite aside from what with the liberal right to amend that we have in modern practice at the trial level could morph into. The fact remains is that it is entirely premised upon bodily injury. And under the theory pleaded in the underlying complaint, if there hadn't been this bodily injury, then there could not have been a false claim, and therefore, the way the policy is written, the bodily injury is what is the because of for the false claim. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. And thank you, Ms. Wetherill. And the case will be taken under advisement.